This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
What was once predicted only by models is now playing out in real time across the world. Extreme rains flood desert cities. Heat records are smashed daily on multiple continents. Professor Wolfgang Kramer has documented it all since the early 1990s. This IPCC author, with over 150 peer-reviewed papers, joins other scientists and academics calling on the public to become climate advocates and activists. Wolfgang was a longtime scientist at the Potsdam Institute. He is now director of research and professor of global ecology at the Mediterranean Institute for Marine and Terrestrial Biodiversity and Ecology, and that's located at Aix Marseille Université. From France, Wolfgang Kramer, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, as climate destabilizes the life support systems, it's pretty frightening. Are some places becoming too dangerous to live in?
That may be the case, that some places become too dangerous to live in, but that will not be the same for each and everyone in the population. So when we talk about dangerous places, then we mostly look at the fact that the poor people are the ones that are worse hit by climate warming, while richer people are able still to protect themselves with air conditioning and other systems. And the Mediterranean is an excellent case to illustrate that.
Several of our recent guests worry loss of habitability will lead to mass migration towards safer places like Europe, North America, or Australia. But in a recent presentation at a French university, you said there are no climate migrants. Why?
Yeah, there are no climate migrants in the strict sense because empirical research has shown that if you actually talk to migrants, and there I'm mostly talking about migrants who migrate because of suffering, because of difficulties in their lives, and most of the time these people will not mention climate change as the primary cause for their distress. They will say that we no longer can afford to live where we are, we can no longer produce in agriculture, we are at risk from conflict, from an unstable society, and so many of these people suffer from multiple causes, and calling them climate migrants is a way to basically take away all the other factors that make life hard for people in countries that are in distress. So climate migrants, there's a climate part in the migration decision somewhere, but it's rarely the dominant decision.
At the end of April 2024, extreme heat forced school closures for 33 million people in Bangladesh. Within decades, the rising seas, extreme high storm surges, and saltwater intrusion will make large parts of that country uninhabitable, and that's with over 170 million people, and their borders are more or less closed. If they cannot migrate, what happens to them?
Well, the situation in countries like Bangladesh is complex, but it has also been shown that in these countries, people are actually more able, more capable to adapt to changes such as sea level rise, and for example people in the Mediterranean are. Why would that be? That may first sound surprising, but the fact is that most people living along the coastline of Bangladesh live in very simple and poor housing that can be actually placed higher up in places further north in the country to a certain extent much easier than is the case for expensive holiday condos on the Mediterranean coast or for ship marinas and for other heavy investments that were made by rich people in the Mediterranean. In Bangladesh, I do not at all want to reduce the dramatic consequences that climate change and sea level rise have for the country, and they need to be dealt with, and countries like Bangladesh need substantial help, but they can be helped, and it is possible to protect populations in the country by giving them technical support for establishing livelihoods elsewhere. It is unlikely or it's inconceivable that just the whole population of a large country such as Bangladesh will start to move. That is not an option that they have and that they will consider once they are given other opportunities to maintain their livelihoods in the country.
In earlier years, you studied forests and biology. How did that work carry forward for you into research and publishing about climate change?
Well, this was in the 1980s, when not only I was a young scientist and I did my PhD, but also computers arrived on the scene, and it became possible to use mathematical formulations of processes such as growth and mortality and competition in forests to describe them mathematically and to project what future climate change would bring to them. And this was a very exciting field of research in the 1990s, where a large community that I belonged to developed those computer models that are now a standard feature in the large-scale Earth system models that the IPCC uses to predict the future of the planet. For me, it was quite natural when I discovered that there was such a broad public interest in our calculations that I would spend actually more time making sure that the outcomes from computer models were communicated appropriately to people and were also seen in the social and economic context than myself staying in the modeling community where I was initially. So it was a natural process from the production of scientific results to maybe more communication and more synthesis in the context of telling the public and aiding policymakers to hopefully take meaningful decisions in the face of the risks that are caused by climate change.
Wolfgang, you were a longtime scientist at the Potsdam Institute. Recently, that institute and its director, Stefan Ramsdorf, issued a broad public warning about climate tipping points. On Radio EcoShock, a series of PIC scientists, including Levka Caesar, said the big North Atlantic ocean current that warms northern Europe could weaken or eventually fail. What do you think?
First of all, I have to recognize that some people have worked on this topic very hard, and in the case of Stefan Ramsdorf, for more than 30 years. So I have a tendency to look at their papers as an inspiration rather than criticizing them, because I'm not a physical oceanographer. So what Professor Ramsdorf is showing very clearly is that the changes in the North Atlantic circulation with the associated climate change have occurred on several occasions in the geological past. So it is not an unknown phenomenon that sort of has never been heard of. But he also has shown with his colleagues and with a large network of international colleagues that there are now growing and ever stronger indications that we might actually be rather near such a point again, where the production of deep water in the North Atlantic essentially would stop, and therefore a much reduced flow of warm water from the south, warm surface water from the south, not just from the Gulf of Mexico, but from the southern Atlantic, that flow would stop or be greatly reduced. This is not something that is very easy to model, and therefore there are some other experts who say they find this rather unlikely. But I believe that this accumulated evidence that not only Stefan Ramsdorf but also others have delivered over the years makes this process likely to occur. It can still not be predicted with precision. But as he points out, the major issue for humanity with this is that we cannot actually afford to make mistakes there. In other words, if we were predicting the shutdown of the Atlantic circulation and it didn't happen, okay, that would be not such a big problem. But if we said, oh, we don't know, we cannot really predict it, so let's assume it will never happen, that would be a very dangerous position. It would be similar to boarding an airplane and not really knowing whether the airplane will land, or maybe someone says, okay, nine of the 10 last airplanes that have departed from this airport have successfully reached their destination. And you would say, well, one out of 10 hasn't reached it? That is not good enough for me. So all in all, what this community argues for, and it's been corroborated also by studies in the Netherlands and elsewhere, is that we cannot simply run that risk of shutdown of the North Atlantic circulation. We must stop global warming now, and that can only be done by reducing greenhouse gas emissions at a much higher rate than we have done so far.
You specialize in the environment of the Mediterranean. Please tell us about climate-driven impacts and extreme weather over the past year in that region that have struck you.
Yeah, first of all, as your question implies, there's a difference between the long-term trend, which is warming virtually everywhere on the planet, and the incidence of extreme events such as heat waves and storms and other events. They go together, but they are independent processes. And first of all, we have to recognize that the Mediterranean basin warms much faster than the global average. The global average, as you know, we are at 1.2 degrees above the pre-industrial. The Mediterranean basin is somewhere between 1.7, 1.8. So it's already on average warmer than it has been, than the rest of the planet has warmed. But this hits an area where we already have pretty high temperatures in summer and pretty dry conditions in summer. And so what happens with this additional warming is several things. First of all, that the heat waves, which are not unknown. People in the Mediterranean are familiar with heat waves, but these heat waves become longer and more intensive and therefore more deadly for those people who cannot protect themselves against them. And also because evaporation from the soil is increasing due to these high temperatures, there is more drought and significantly less water available for agricultural systems, but also for human use. And just to mention one example, the area of the eastern Pyrenees, basically Catalonia and the big city of Barcelona, has completely run out of water to the extent that they are now importing water by ship and potentially by a pipeline from the southeastern France, where the rivers from the Alps still supply sufficient water. So these are big-scale adaptation measures that are becoming necessary in order to deal with the water crisis. I've already mentioned the difficulties with heat waves that make it particularly hard for people with low income to continue to live, to not be affected by dehydration and by subsequent health problems. That is a problem particularly in the Eastern Mediterranean, which comes on top of the war in Palestine and in Israel and makes conditions even harder for people that are in an extremely situation from the onset. With this, I have not mentioned one factor that is also particularly dramatic in the Mediterranean, and that is sea level rise. We've already talked about Bangladesh and sea level rise, but in the Mediterranean, the situation is particular because Mediterranean coastal ecosystems and also Mediterranean infrastructure, such as ports and cities and even heritage sites such as Venice and others, are built very close to mean water level. And why is that? That is because there's no tidal movement in the Mediterranean, or hardly any. There's some in the northern Adriatic, but for the rest of the Mediterranean, there's no tidal movement, so water levels are in general very stable. But if they continue to rise worldwide, they will also continue to rise in the Mediterranean. We are now well above 5 millimeters per year in sea level rise worldwide. And this in a situation where both ecosystems and human infrastructure are adapted to a very precise water level, and sometimes have been so for thousands of years, this causes problems that are very hard to deal with. And as you may have heard, the city of Venice has now built a sort of unfoldable sea wall that can be lifted out of the water when sea level runs very high. That has been a multi-billion-dollar project that has cost a lot of money and causes ecological repercussions in the Venice Lagoon. This system will be out of, will no longer be useful at the end of the century when sea level rises continues at current rates, because sea level is so high that the design range of that system will be exceeded.
And I think the same is true about the Thames River barrier in the UK. It's just not going to be high enough. They'll have to build it higher or do something else. We began by talking about habitability. How do you define that? And what parts of the world can you point to that may be moving outside the human ecological niche?
Yeah, habitability is a term that I think is very useful to describe a number of things in combination with each other. The first is, of course, the physical possibility for human life, or for that sake, for life of any other species, to even occur. I mean, there are physiological limits. We cannot live above certain temperatures. We cannot live completely without water. We cannot live underwater. We can map principle on the map areas where life for the human species without protection is not possible. And such areas exist already today. They exist at the center of major deserts, where there's essentially life possible only in specific places like oases or other, with other forms of protection, or in the very high mountains, or in the middle of Greenland. So it is not so that currently any square meter of this planet is habitable, and it's also clear that with warming, the areas where the strict physiological constraints for human life are not given, or the conditions are not given, that those areas may increase. But for human civilization as we know it today, this is a only partially useful concept, because in reality, as we all know, we protect ourselves by building houses, by having air conditioning, by having heating systems, by protecting us against the rain, by irrigating our agricultural fields. So there is, in the term of habitability, there is a notion of economy and also of technical solutions. And what we notice now, as we start to study this a little more closely, is that habitability does decline for people on the planet, and also for many other species, and in part it declines because of warming in the hottest areas, for example, in the driest areas, in the Sahara and the Sahel zone, in central Australia, in other areas. But more importantly, habitability declines because of social conditions. They decline because people are not, because of poor economy or because of wars or because of conflict or because of other phenomena, they are not able to protect themselves against climate anymore or against difficult conditions. And this must be seen in context, and research is now starting to sort this out a little bit more structured, and to then be able to answer the question that you're raising. If we talk about the Mediterranean basin, then yes, sea level rise will reduce the areas where people can live, for example, in the Nile Delta. Yes, heat waves will be more dramatic and more severe in the south of Spain and in the whole eastern part of the basin, and thereby make life difficult for both farmers and also for other people. But most of all, the lack of capacity to protect people against difficulties of climate is increasing because of the war, because of the general economic instability, and these things come together and reduce habitability for a lot of people.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Professor Wolfgang Kramer from the Mediterranean Institute for Biodiversity and Ecology in France. We're talking about big picture survival, climate, and beyond. Wolfgang Kramer, for years you contributed to scientific reports by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. What is the relationship between the IPCC and those annual climate meetings known as the Conference of the Parties?
Yeah, let me explain that briefly. I mean, as you know, in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro, the world came together and signed a number of conventions, which are essentially legal documents declaring certain goals for humanity, and one of them is the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which in its text stipulates a number of things, one of them being that countries should work together and do everything they can to avoid dangerous climate change. That's what Article 2 in that convention says. And what it also says, like many other UN conventions, is that every year country representatives should come together and look at the state of affairs with regard to the objectives of the convention. In other words, have we done enough in order to avoid dangerous climate change? That is what is called the conference of the parties being the members of the countries who have signed the convention. So every year since 1992, there's a COP, a conference of the parties, and the representatives of all governments come together and discuss. What they need to do in order to take decisions and redesign their policies at that stage is scientific information. And for providing that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climatic Change, the IPCC, was already founded a little before the 1992, and it was in 1988. But the IPCC has a mandate from governments to produce these reports, which then governments will use for a number of purposes, including the discussions at the COPs on how to strengthen efforts for protecting the world against the consequences of climate change. So IPCC reports are published every 6 or 7 years. We are now entering the 7th cycle. They are written by scientists, but they are called upon by governments, and governments will carefully look at them and read them and ask a lot of questions in the final approval session. And at the end of that session, there's a magic moment, if you will, where governments conclude that now we have taken notice of this report and we all agree that that report represents the best state of our knowledge. This is important for the COPs, because the same government can then not logically go to the conference of the parties and say, oh, we don't believe this scientific report that we've seen, because actually they have just approved it. Perhaps the best way to describe the connection between the climate change convention process and the development of the IPCC reports.
Well, part of the reason I ask is that many people are becoming disillusioned with the COP process after 30 years of meetings. Greenhouse gas emissions have never been higher, and the last two conferences were held in oil-producing countries. So I wonder whether a sort of apathy or even anger about the failure of the COP process will wash back towards the excellent science in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and that you may find in the future that some people that should be your friends are pushing back because they're so disillusioned by the COP process.
I think you mentioned a very, very important point, and one that I think all scientists who are involved in the process have been asking themselves about already for quite a number of years. But of course, the situation is becoming ever more dramatic every year with the increasing damages, increasing losses of life, increasing losses of ecosystems due to the failure of governments to develop appropriate policies. I was in a French national meeting today on the future of the IPCC process. I did not sense a frustration of my, or there's frustration, but not a lack of engagement among my colleagues. I think many of us still maintain that what we do is extremely important, not just for governments to be well advised, but also for situations like elections, where really everyone who gets to elect the future representatives in government can compare what is the action that has been undertaken by governments and what is the what were the recommendations made by the scientists that the governments themselves have approved. So in democratic societies, many of us believe that this role is still very important and needs to be maintained and strengthened perhaps even, but that doesn't mean that we are not frustrated with a lack of progress.
And given jaw-dropping weather events and ocean heat and fast melting poles and many other things, do you think the Intergovernmental Panel reports and predictions have been too conservative?
There are cases where they needed to be corrected because of new evidence. And that, I would say, in the scientific community is a normal process. There have even been cases where some statements in earlier reports have been corrected to, as we found out, that systems were less sensitive to climate change than we initially anticipated. So I would defend the process. I would say we are doing as good as we can in terms of producing summaries of the existing scientific knowledge. And I would argue that it's not inherently conservative. It is true that, like I was mentioning earlier in this conversation about the North Atlantic circulation, is that there's a tendency, if the uncertainty is very high, then to say, well, maybe it will not happen. We could say that sometimes stronger words in terms of maybe it will not happen, but if it happens, it is really, really, very bad. People should perhaps be more willing to make those statements than we have done in the past. But the evidence that's being reported in the chapters and the underlying chapters of the IPCC reports, that evidence is as good as the scientific effort is, which means has limits, but it's neither conservative nor alarmist.
Well, you were early to adopt computers, and scientists already use machine learning to cope with masses of data. Do you think artificial intelligence can help humans protect biodiversity and adapt to climate change? Would you approve of AI using human psychology to achieve these goals?
Well, there are two different questions there. I think the first question is, does artificial intelligence, machine learning, help in the process of the scientific assessment? And I'm convinced that it does. We are in early stages of development, and it is clear that we will see a lot of drawbacks as we see successes. But this is powerful technology that we need to learn and we need to look at critically. And it will, in the end, just like word processors or statistics programs or other things, will be useful. Whether the human psychology will be benefiting or can be influenced by it will certainly be influenced in negative ways by artificial intelligence. We already see that the marketing industry is making heavy use of these techniques, and I find that very, very doubtful, and another reason for why really everyone in society needs to understand the basics of this, and we must have a very critical eye on this. I do not think that this actually will help us in any way in terms of better policy making, protecting the planet, simply because this is not about psychology. It is about power. It is about our willingness to limit the influence of some very large fossil fuel companies. And this is a debate which has nothing to do really with artificial intelligence. It has to do more with democracy and with the availability of information to every citizen in every country.
What is climate resilient development? And tell us about the transformation project you are working to develop.
Yes, climate resilient development is a term that has arrived on the scene rather recently. And it essentially implies that if you talk about initiatives to help people and communities to protect themselves against climate hardships, in a way, against difficulties economically or environmentally, that you have to take climate change into account, both in terms of our capacity to adapt to climate change, but also in terms of the need to not contribute to climate change. So in other words, if you look at to take a practical example, if you look at the agricultural sector and the food industry, then you can, of course, make perhaps more drought-resistant crops, or you can influence irrigation techniques, but you should do this, but this does not actually increase climate resilience. It just increases the capacity of some part of the system to work. If you take a more systemic approach, and if you ask more what do people actually need in order to have a healthy food supply, and what do farmers actually need in order to be able to work under decent living conditions, then this will probably mean changes in technology that are rather different from just getting a more drought-resilient crop. The climate-resilient development means taking into account all needs of people and not just needs of some technology to be adapted to different climatic conditions. Yes, and the transformation project, you asked about that. There's a new research program being launched in France this year, which is indeed about transformation. And it is at the same time a new and engaging project in order to study environmental systems and the management of environmental systems in France with the aim of improving livelihoods for people and the conditions for ecosystems. So this is new, you could say, and we intend to establish a new research center for being able to develop these ideas. But it's also standing on the shoulders of a lot of existing research. In France, there are a number of long-term studies ongoing on social ecological conditions in major river catchments, mostly in river catchments, also in some mountain areas, where colleagues for sometimes two decades or more have studied how do people actually influence the environment and how can we change the decision-making, for example, about alpine pastoralism or about the management of agriculture and water quality in the Seine River Basin and other such systems. These long-term studies, we will try to integrate some of them into a more coherent and more transformation-oriented picture. The deep collaboration between natural scientists, social scientists, and also humanities.
We have been speaking with leading scientist Dr. Wolfgang Kramer. Please find links to all the science and news we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Wolfgang, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thanks very much, Alex, for excellent questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. Ecoshock.org.